across northern sections of Iowa and Wisconsin to the upper 40s across southwestern Missouri. Low temperatures tonight will range from the upper teens in northern Wisconsin to the mid-30s in southern Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, cloudy, the high 38, the wind from the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 28. The wind will be out of the south from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain during the afternoon. Expect a high of 42. The wind from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, rain is likely. The low 38. The wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then from the west after midnight. Thursday, cloudy with a chance of rain or snow Thursday morning, then partly sunny in the afternoon. We'll see a high in the low 40s. The wind will be from the northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Thursday night through the weekend, partly cloudy with lows in the upper 20s and highs in the low to mid 40s. At noon central time, it was cloudy across Illinois and Indiana. Temperatures were in the 30s. At Rockford, 34 degrees. Chicago's O'Hare Airport reported flurries at the top of the hour and 33 degrees. Bloomington, 32. At Mattoon, it was 34. And at Carbondale, 39. South Bend reported 32 degrees. In Lafayette, it was 34. In Indianapolis and in Terre Haute, 35 degrees. Willard Airport reported a cloudy sky at the top of the hour, 34 degrees. The dew point, 30. The relative humidity, 85%. The wind out of the west at 9, giving us a wind chill of 27 degrees. And the barometric pressure, 29.91 and steady. At 12:39, 33 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois, and the sky is cloudy. The natural gas boom in Pennsylvania has new workers flooding into the state. That's causing a housing crunch in some communities as locals get priced out of the rental market. One rural county in the northern part of the state has opened its first homeless shelter. Emily Reddy of member station WPSU has more.
It's dinner time at the Jemison Valley Brethren in Christ Church in Tioga County. The church sits alone along a two-lane highway in rural northern Pennsylvania. Off the main room, cots have been set up in the Sunday school classrooms. But right now, everyone's in the dining room.
Well, we have mashed potatoes, gravy, meatloaf, green beans, cranberries, and a ton of cookies.
The women from the church press visitors to fill their plates. But this isn't your typical Sunday church supper. It's a meal for the homeless. And this church is a makeshift shelter. After he eats, Doug Harris does dishes in the kitchen.
Well, I have slept in my car on a few cold nights before the shelter. You know, and I'm glad the shelters are here for, you know, for me, because this is kind of hard to sleep in a car.
Harris had to quit working because of his diabetes. He's been on a waiting list for low-income housing for 6 months.
In the past, you know, you could have gotten in a couple of months.
Abby Thorborg is the one who placed Harris in the shelter. She's also the one who came up with the idea to have churches house and feed the homeless. Six other churches are also taking part. Thorborg is a Tioga County housing specialist. She says when drilling grew, so did homelessness.
Once they started coming in, I started seeing more people and more families and, you know, I've lost my housing. What can I do? And I'm not in no way, shape, or form blaming it on the gas industry, because I always say any industry coming in, we had a housing shortage before. Now it's even worse.
Marcellus Shale drilling is so new, there's not a lot of research on its impact on housing. Two professors at Lycoming College are trying to put numbers to it. Benita Kolb and Jonathan Williamson talked with politicians, community planners, developers, renters, and social service agencies. Kolb says what they found is that the housing shortage is a domino effect.
People who can't find really nice housing move into okay housing. People in okay housing move into rundown housing, and people who are living in rundown housing, they fall off the ladder.
With all the new workers in town, the laws of supply and demand are in full effect. Houses that rented for $600 or $800 a month just a few years ago can now rent for as much as $3,000. Drillers are piling into houses, living in RVs, and renting out whole hotels for months at a time. Back at the church, Doug Harris will head off to his cot in the basement soon. He's hoping he won't have to rely on the churches for much longer.
I did all my paperwork already, and hopefully I'm in line before long to get housing.
The researchers say the only real solution to the housing shortage in northern Pennsylvania is time. It could take several years to build enough new housing. Meanwhile, Abby Thorborg is working on plans for a permanent homeless shelter. She's already received a donation from the people working at the nearby Shell drilling rig.
That report from Emily Reddy of member station WPSU. The Department of Defense is looking to cut $500 billion from its budget over the next decade. Defense officials want to push many of the planned cuts on to the National Guard and reserves. This is already leading to a campaign by guard backers to keep their forces strong. But active duty military say cuts in recent years have taken too much from them. So it's the guard's turn. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
When the Pentagon says cut the budget, military towns around the country get nervous. Take Fort Wayne, Indiana. The Air Force plans to shrink the 122nd Fighter Wing, where Air National Guard pilots fly A-10 Warthogs. Mike Landrum, president of the Greater Fort Wayne Chamber of Commerce, says that base means a lot to the surrounding community.
About $58 million of economic impact. And if you total up the reservists plus the civilian, state, federal workforce there, you've got a combined total of about 1,200 folks.
Now, it's not certain just how big the cuts to this Air National Guard base will be, but overall, the Air Force plans to retire over 200 aircraft, including a lot of A-10s. And Air Force cuts in the coming years will fall disproportionately on Guard and Reserve troops. Retired Air Force Lieutenant General Mike Dunn explains why.
The Guard and Reserve really have not been reduced much in the last decade, while the active forces have been.
In fact, back in 1990, the Guard and Reserve made up 25% of the Air Force. Now it's up to 35%. Air Force officials say it's simple math. The Guard and Reserves have to shrink more than active duty forces. But many members of Congress say if we're cutting the budget, grow the Guard. A part-time airman costs about a quarter as much as a full-timer. Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina took to the floor of the Senate last week to recall the Guard's service in Iraq and Afghanistan.
When you go into the combat theater, you can't tell the difference between Guard, Reserve, or active duty member, which is a testament to all three.
And Democrat Patrick Leahy of Vermont said the Guard and Reserve represent the kind of military the country needs as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq come to a close.
Turn to our historic roots as a militia nation. It means we should return to the constitutional construct for our military in the days we maintain a smaller standing military.
Senators Graham and Leahy promised to fight these cuts. Concern about the unsung role of the National Guard led to the creation of a seat on the Joint Chiefs of Staff this year. That move came over the objections of the other branches. General Craig McKinley took his post on the Joint Chiefs on January 1st, maybe too soon to assess whether he's having an impact. Retired Major General Gus Hargett, head of the National Guard Association, says he thinks the Guard does need better PR. He realized this when he flew a mission a few years back to Uzbekistan.
I was met on the ramp by an active Air Force wing commander. They had 16 C-130s sitting on the ramp. Every one of them belonged to the Air Guard. But there was nothing out there that ever said, okay, we deployed an Air Guard wing.
In the end, Guard supporters will also have to argue they fit into the Pentagon's new strategy for a smaller, more nimble force focused on the Pacific and the Middle East. Retired Air Force Lieutenant General Mike Dunn says Guard and Reserve forces are not designed for every mission.
remember, these guys have civilian jobs, and while they're patriots, you know, they are militia. They are supposed to be a reserve, not a primary response force.
The Fort Wayne, Indiana Chamber of Commerce is mounting a letter-writing campaign to fight the cuts to the 122nd Fighter Wing. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and members of Congress should be getting plenty of messages as these cuts hit home. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Today, WILL is joining WUIS in Springfield and WVIK in the Quad Cities for a day of support in Illinois for public radio. And when you make a pledge of financial support today to celebrate the love of public radio on this Valentine's Day, we have a little gift to send in your pledge packet. Everyone who makes a pledge of support today will receive an iHeart NPR bumper sticker. Call 217-244-9455 now to make your pledge and tell us why you love public radio. That's 217-244-9455. It's 12:48. China is at the heart of a rare public relations crisis for the company Apple and its new CEO, Tim Cook. Cook is dealing with allegations of worker mistreatment at Chinese plants where Apple products are made. NPR's Steve Henn has the story.
Mary Spaeth says Apple has a big problem.
Short term, what they need to do is convince us that they care.
She specializes in crisis communications.
Now, that may not have been Steve Jobs' MO, but it certainly needs to be Mr. Cook's.
Last month, Apple joined the Fair Labor Association, and this week, the FLA began auditing one of Apple's largest suppliers, Foxconn.
We're looking at three sites.
Orette Van Heerden is president of the FLA.
Each one is over 100,000 workers.
Van Heerden's auditors plan to interview tens of thousands of workers at these plants. Apple will pay for it.
That could be of some value, but it is misleading to the public to present that as a process of independent investigation.
Scott Nova is executive director of the Workers' Rights Consortium, which does its own audits in China. He's critical of the FLA approach.
They talk to workers in the factory or in the dorms, and the result, for obvious reasons, is that workers are often not comfortable speaking candidly, and so critical issues can be missed.
Van Heerden differs.
Workers are very outspoken. They're not intimidated at all.
Van Heerden says the Fair Labor Association's report will draw back the curtain on Foxconn, no matter what the auditors find. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Certain areas of Champaign and Urbana are flooded every few years due to inadequate or deteriorated storm sewers. Officials in both cities say they need more money to maintain and improve those storm sewers, and they think charging a new stormwater utility fee would help. I'm Jim Meadows. I'll report on how the stormwater utility fee would work, why some people like the idea and others don't. Be listening Wednesday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered on WILL.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 14th of February, 2012. Today is Valentine's Day, a big day for greeting cards and for candy sales, which goes back more than 1,500 years to the Feast of St. Valentine, established in the 5th century. Though nobody is sure exactly which of many St. Valentines it is the feast day of. But the ancient Romans had a fertility festival in mid-February called Lupercalia, when young men ran naked in the streets wearing strips of goatskin, which they gently whipped young women with to improve their fertility. And Lupercalia was still popular long after the Roman Empire was officially Christian, so the church simply came in and renovated it. In the 14th century, Chaucer wrote about St. Valentine's Day as a romantic occasion in his long poem, The Parliament of Fowls. In the early 15th century, the Duke of Orleans, held captive in the Tower of London, wrote a Valentine's Day poem to his wife. Shakespeare mentions the sending of valentines in a speech by Ophelia in Hamlet. It was on this day, 1895, Oscar Wilde's play The Importance of Being Earnest opened in London, wrote it in just 21 days, the first draft at least, fastest he had ever written anything. The story of a man named Jack Worthing, who pretends to have a younger brother named
Ernest, who he can use as an excuse for getting out of things, and he even pretends to be Ernest when that suits his purpose. And his friend Algernon also starts impersonating the imaginary Ernest. So two women fall in love with the same fictional person. Oscar Wilde said the play expressed his philosophy that we should treat all the trivial things of life very seriously and all the serious things with studied triviality. Here are two poems for Valentine's Day, two sonnets by William Shakespeare. The one you all know, sonnet number 116. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh, no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not.